And now we present to you Thaco with Advantage.
Welcome to Thaco with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we both love lots of other RPGs, D&D was our training wheels for getting into role-playing games.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the Gnomecast, the Stew's podcast, since 2017. And in 2021, I became head gnome, and we started this show 2 years ago now, I think. So yeah, I like games.
I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew. And as I've been doing these introductions, I've just been thinking about how every one of these makes me sound old. So now I just thought, what could make me sound old? And I'll just point out that, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't have this fancy crowdfunding. People had to go broke on their own. In addition to writing reviews on Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinowjr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
After we look at the games we're running or playing in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about the wide range of player experience and skill and how to run games for those various levels. Then we'll have some recommendations of D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Now stand by for station identification. This is WDND The Role Player. Now we're going to McElroy McKinney and the Bardic College.
According to the D&D 3rd Edition Dungeon Master's Guide, a well-constructed adventure will consist of 10% easy encounters, 20% conditionally easy encounters, 50% challenging encounters. For example, the encounter level is equal to the average party level, 15% very difficult encounters, once again, for example, 1 to 4 encounter levels above the party average, and 5% overpowering, which means that the encounter is 4 or more levels above the average party level. Now that we know that part of the equation, if a challenging encounter should use 20% of the party's resources and characters should level up after 13.33 encounters equal to their average party level, how many times will the party sleep before they get killed trying to complete the City of the Spider Queen?
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
So, since the last time we talked, I've gotten to play in Jared's Tales of the Valiant test run that we're doing once a month, as well as the Cygnus de Gur campaign. I'll let Jared talk about Tales of the Valiant, but I can get into the Monkeys of War. So last session, we had left the underground temple catacombs where there'd been a statue that we had to put the heart back in it and stop some people from doing bad things and mining powerful ore off of the statue. We teleported into the Underdark. Almost immediately, we stumbled onto these two massive scorpion construct things. There were webs all around, serving as difficult terrain, but we were able to deal with them fairly easily. They weren't hard to hit, but they did hit really hard when they connected. Wonder, our tabaxi rogue, got hit pretty hard, but since no one else got hurt, his wounds were kind of overlooked, and he had to, you know, quickly down a potion before the next fight, because he kind of forgot to tell everyone, hey, I lost 3/4 of my hit points in that fight. We did have a moment where we were all like, you know, and this is the type of thing you'll find happens in most games where we're in a situation, we obviously have things to do, and we're all like, why are we here? What are we doing? Why are we in the Underdark? And, you know, we quickly had to, you know, like kind of regroup and say, we're here because the drow were doing stuff in the temple that we were in. And we don't want them to come back, and there's some sort of war happening down here. So we're just here to kind of put a stop to things so they don't come back and start hurting that village anymore. So after the fight with the construct scorpion things, our next fight turned out to be a stable. It was basically a bunch of nasty-looking lizard mounts with some drow stable hands and a more experienced drow guard. Amusingly, we had some gender confusion for the poor captain of the guard here, because drow society is, generally speaking, matriarchal, which means a lot of the people in leadership positions are women, but because the token looked like a dude, the GM and us players kept calling them him instead of her, and like we kept going, no, it's her. And I believe in the write-up, it was actually a woman. He just had somehow ended up with a male token. Anyway, big fight, lots of lizard mounts, a bunch of drow stable hands, and the one guard. Of course, somebody had to cast reverse gravity on the whole room. And there was a moment where I had Selena kind of grumble to Wonder as she goes, "By God damn it, with this reverse gravity." At which point she jumps into the reverse gravity, makes an athletics check to land properly on the ceiling and just start fighting things up there. I love doing this stuff in games because it's like, you want to be the big damn hero. You want to do the fun cinematic action stuff. And you know what? If the fight's on the ceiling, I'll go to the ceiling. Now, Wonder, because he had gotten pretty hurt in the last fight, was a bit wary of getting too close to the lizard things as we fought them. So he kept doing the run in, stab it, and then use his rogue shenanigans to get away from it again, which meant I was never really able to use my Commander Strike on him to make him attack, which lets us get his sneak attack damage bonus and all that, because we know the loopholes. Anyway, that fight was fun. It took a little while, but it was fun. And then when it was done, we decided, let me just say, some of us decided we could use a short rest. Others in the party were like, why? Why do we need a short rest? I still have spell slots. And Selena and the Warlock are sitting here going, you may have, but we don't. Not that Selena has spell slots, but I'd pretty much used up the one that gives you hit points back. I used up over half of her points to make, you know, do special moves and stuff like that. Malcolm, our Warlock, he was just tapped out of all of his stuff. I mean, he still had Eldritch Blast, but that was about it.
That's all you need when you're a Warlock.
Everyone finally agreed, let's take a short rest. We found this little alcove with this creepy rock formation that looked like a hand grasping out of the ground. And as we took the rest, we kind of realized that that rock outcropping kind of pointed at a weird hole in the ceiling, and we realized it was a passage to a secret entrance into another room. And so we got in there, and that's where we ended until the next time we play.
It was funny when you were talking about forgetting why you're there, and it just reminded me of all of the times when I am playing a computer RPG, and I'm like, why did I go to this place? I was going to do something here, but I have no idea what it is. Hit J.
Yep. I think we all have that happen. Even your most dedicated players will occasionally have those moments, especially if you're not playing. If you're playing weekly, maybe people remember a little more. But even then, you know, most of us are grown-ass adults and have a lot of stuff going on. And you'll get to game night and you're super excited to play. And then you're like, what were we doing? I kind of forgot.
The funny thing about the lizard mount, that actually reminded me of the Pathfinder adventure path. The very first one, there's a fight with a goblin chief and he is on a lizard mount. And this was the first time that I really tried to use something like this, but I had, you know, the lizard mount like running along the ceiling and along the walls and everything. And boy, did some of those players not appreciate that. Like, well, it can stick to things. Why don't I make it stick to things? Which will be a theme coming up in some of my summary here, too.
Yes, yes.
I'm just going to briefly touch on our Tales of the Valiant game, but we have our Tales of the Valiant game set up. We are not converting anything from 2014, but we are using the Thrones and Bones setting and some of the options from that from Lazy Wolf Studios. And we are running everything through Shard, which most of the material is already available in Shard. I'll be updating people on that a little bit more in future campaign journals. I will just leave you with the idea that they stopped when they found inflatable cats.
I mean, I'll add on to that. We had a lot of fun. There was a lot of getting into character and leaning into various aspects of things. Let's just say show editor Chris Nizek is a blast.
Yes. So we didn't get to play our Thursday game because I have been sick of various things for like 2 weeks running, and then I was not sleeping. So between not sleeping and being sick, sometimes it's hard to run games. I have been super unreliable and I feel bad about that.
Don't feel too bad about it because we've skipped games because other people have been sick and you got to take care of you.
I know. I mean, If this were someone else I were talking to, I would completely understand and be telling them the same thing. But since it's me, I cannot tell myself these things and actually trust myself. I did get to run my Curse of Strahd game for my daughter and my daughter-in-law and their friends. And our first thing was that our player that was part of our very original 5e game like a year and a half ago when we started this, she has come back. She was not available for a while, but she has come back. And one of the other players decided we should sneak her in and bring her in at a thematically appropriate moment. I had her character being put in the stocks in Valaki and, you know, her protesting so that the players would go see what the thing was. And then as soon as they walked in, I was going to say, hey, would you like to play your character? We kind of did that, except that Morgan saw her walk around the corner. And after she walks around the corner, both dogs just run straight over to her.
Dogs and toddlers spoiling surprises for a millennia.
But we got her back in the game. I should have known this from my players, especially the cleric, because the Burgermeister's thug that has the grafted fiendish arm was one of the people that was there. And instead of trying to talk their way out of getting this character from being put in the stocks, our somewhat not empathetic cleric walked up to him and swung her mace at him. So this turned into an initiative situation. That was kind of a rough fight. The other guards really weren't that powerful, but the guy, he was making, you know, multiple great axe attacks and could throw fire with his fiendish graft arm. So that was a little bit difficult for them, but they did manage to drop him and then decided not to kill him in the middle of the street, because if they just beat him up, they just look like rabble rousers. If they murder somebody working for the Burgermeister, that might be worse. And I'm glad they thought about that.
I mean, I'd be wondering if they thought about that with her starting the fight by hitting him in the face with a mace, but...
No, no, everything is afterthought in this game. They did run into the older woman who wants her son rescued from the Burgermeister's dungeons beneath his mansion, and that brought them to the church where there's another quest. And that quest leads you to an area where there are 6 vampire spawn. They did not do the quest that they were given first, which was to scout out the Burgermeister's house and see if they could free the son. They decided, hey, let's get these bones back for this chapel immediately, which took them straight into the fight with the 6 vampire spawn. Now, these are 4 characters of 4th level. So 6 vampire spawns is really rough. Like, when they were 3rd level, 1 vampire spawn was a rough fight for them. However, last session they just got the Holy Symbol of Ravenkind, which has a couple of neat functions when it comes to dealing with vampires, one of which is to create sunlight in a 30-foot radius, and the other one is to specifically paralyze vampires. Many charges were used from that magic item. They put up the sunlight, they paralyzed them, they did it twice just to make sure they could get more of them that weren't paralyzed the first time. The whole fight, there were between 3 and 5 of these 6 vampire spawn being paralyzed. So every round, they're taking 20 hit points. And even with all of that going for them, the wizard was making death saves before the fight was over. And also, I think at least 2 or 3 of them have heavily reduced maximum hit points from being hit from the spawn and having, you know, your maximum hit point drained down.
Now, the wizard is the new character, right?
Yes. And it was funny because my daughter was like, one of these almost killed us before. Why did you think we could handle 6 of them? I was like, you had an entire town full of adventure hooks that you could have followed up on, and you followed up on this one. It was not an actual fight. It was just kind of amusing that, like, all of these other things you could have followed up on first, you're like this close to getting a level. Nope.
This is like in the video game. You go to that place, you get your butt kicked, you reload, you go, I'm going to go explore some other stuff before going back there. We don't get to do that in tabletop RPGs.
Nope. It was funny, our new player, when she was making her character, she just kind of did the bare bones of it because she wasn't around for me to directly help her out with it. I got access to her character on D&D Beyond, so I made a few tweaks, but she told me that she has been binge watching True Blood. So she wanted to play a vampire who could heal people with her blood and was very upset that her life was messed up. She wanted to be an elf too. So we made her an elf Dampier using the lineages from Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft. And I gave her the healer feat, and we flavored it to say, no, you're not using uses out of a healer's kit. You're actually just cutting yourself and bleeding on them. Because, I mean, that feat isn't that bad anyway, because you're just letting them use their own hit dice.
Yeah.
And she thought that was great. So we ended up creating the character that she had envisioned. So I was happy about that.
Welcome to the Dungeon Master's Workshop.
We've talked before about some considerations to have when running for brand new players, but based on a question we got from one of our patrons, we wanted to delve a little bit deeper and talk about how to run games for players with differing skills, from sparkling newbies to grizzled tactical veterans. First off, let us talk a little bit about what we actually mean when we're talking about this. What do we mean by skill? What do we mean by experience? What are we actually trying to wrap our arms around with this topic?
Touched on this a little bit before in the past, where we've talked about things you have to adjust in your style of running games when you're running for brand new players.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's a matter of familiarity with the tropes and tools of the game and experience with how to use those in the game as you go. And you'll find a lot of newer players, even if they're a little familiar with what D&D is, there's still going to be that learning curve of how does this all work? And there will be some times where they do things that are not, quote unquote, optimal. Meanwhile, they usually graduate into what we'll call, I'm stealing all of this from Savage Worlds. We have novice players, we have seasoned players, we have veteran players. But they'll graduate into seasoned players who are more comfortable with the general tropes of the game and kind of what their character can do. And then that'll grow into tactical players, veterans, who basically are extremely familiar with the tropes of the game, are extremely comfortable with the rules of the game, and they know how to work together with the other players at the table to do things in a way that works much more efficiently and deals with things a lot easier than the way the GM expects based on that CR rating for the encounter.
Well, it's really interesting. I started thinking about, like, what does this kind of mean over different eras of D&D? And I almost think that you have some conflicting things that have come up over the years, and I've even seen this with some older players, because one of the things I wanted to stress here is being familiar with the game you are playing now. Someone can be playing for 6 months and have that high level of engagement and system mastery and understanding. Someone that's been playing since 1978 can be completely bewildered and be a newbie to the game system because they have never tried to mess with the game system. So it's not really an old or young thing. It's more of a, we're using these rules now. How comfortable are you with these rules?
I guess it's also important to like say, over the years in D&D, there has been different attitudes towards a level of system mastery that players have, because I have a friend I play with. He is a tried and true grognard, and he is always worried about seeming like he's metagaming. You know, and it's like, no, you're not metagaming. You're just making your character more optimal and efficient at doing things. There were certain periods of time in certain GMs that would frown on players trying to optimize their character to be more effective in the combats of the game, mm-hmm. because, oh, no, you're cheating. It's like, no, it's not cheating. It's making use of the tools that are in front of you. There are ways that players can over-cheese it and come off like they're cheating, but it's, for the most part, it's just making the best use of what you've got in front of you.
And it's funny because I think we may even want to get into what system mastery is, because this is something that was used a lot in the third edition and the fourth edition era and in Pathfinder. I have not heard the term used quite as much in fifth edition, but basically it is just when you have a game that is very mechanically robust, where there's lots of options, in some cases, if you pick different options, they don't work well together. So it is not, depending on the decisions you make, two characters will not be equally effective at doing the same thing. Therefore, you need to have a little bit of system mastery to understand that if you take this option, it is probably going to make it harder for you to do something that somebody else could do if they took this other option.
Yeah, exactly.
My best example of this isn't even from D&D. It was from when I was running Shadow of the Demon Lord. I had a friend who wanted to have a creepy elf, you know, a sorcerer fighter type character. He started off as a spellcaster, and then, you know, he got to the next tier and he took like a warrior type archetype for that next tier of play. But then he realized that that warrior type that was supposed to be good at using magic in combat still required him to have taken different types of spells than he did when he was just a straight spellcaster. So it wasn't doing him much good because all of his spells were either making him say, either you're going to use your sword or your spell, as opposed to the options that if he would have taken them differently would have been like, you can stab someone and also do this with your spell at the same time.
I think this was a lot more important with third edition, probably a bit in Pathfinder as well, because there were so many more options and so many more feat trees that you had to have certain stats or skills set up for the character to get certain feats that would then let you get other feats that allowed you to do certain things. I appreciate fifth edition for having kind of cleaned up a lot of that and made it less important.
I mean, to the point to where there were designers that would say, some of these feats are terrible feats, but they are basically there to make you invest in something so that later on you can get something later on in the feat tree chain that is super awesome. But if you never want to follow that feat tree chain, then you should never take that opening feat because it's demonstrably worse than everything else in the game that you could get at that point in time.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily my favorite way to design a game, but it is a lot of the design that did show up in third edition and Pathfinder.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we talk a lot about the evolution of the hobby in general, and third edition is definitely a transition period from the more simulationist era of second edition and the late 80s, 90s. And kind of more what we do now, which is like we still want a little bit of crunch to our mechanics, but we don't want it getting in the way of us having fun and doing cool stuff with the game.
Yeah, it's more like I want to have fun widgets to play with. I don't necessarily want to spend 5 levels or 7 levels doing things without any widgets so that I can get the super special widgets later on.
Yeah, and like one of the interesting developments of Pathfinder when it was released was one of their selling points was it did away with dead levels. Dead levels were these times where you would gain a new level for your character and all you would get were some hit points. That's kind of disappointing. And Pathfinder restructured a lot of the leveling so that you were still getting something every level that was, you know, a little more cool for your character. They still have a lot of the moving parts and the system mastery needs you to understand how feats work together and all of that. And it's, you know, to be completely honest, third edition was way better than some of the earlier games that required practically you to have need a math degree to put your characters together. Not necessarily talking about D&D, but some of those 90, you know, late 80s, 90s games, they were very crunchy. They required a lot of mastery of the system, which could take a long time to get to feel like a competent tactical player.
I don't know Hero System what you're talking about.
I love Champions. Champions is what taught me that I could make characters that I wanted to make instead of trying to stay in the lane that D&D was telling me my character needed to stay in. So I love Champions. It broke me out of my shell as far as being a player, but oh my God, I don't got time to play like that anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, I have friends that love the system and that is cool if you want to devote that much time to it. It is not something that ever clicked for me. But speaking of older school players, I did want to bring up that contrast because what we're kind of talking about a lot of times is the system mastery piece. But some of these skills that you were supposed to learn in earlier editions of the game were not really about that system mastery. It was about learning things that the reason I have a 10-foot pole is because every 5 feet of the dungeon, I need to stick this in a hole to make sure there's not a trap. What's really interesting about that, and this is why I'm saying, like, sometimes older assumptions, you know, grind up against newer assumptions, is the point of that style of play at the beginning of the game was really, we're going to go into the dungeon and hopefully we'll survive and come out with treasure. Whereas now it is, no, you are playing heroic characters. You aren't trying to avoid danger. You are trying to deal with danger because you're the only ones that can do it.
Now, there are a lot of OSR games out there that lean into that older style mm-hmm. of play, and some of them can be a lot of fun. Not necessarily always my jam, but mm-hmm. they can be a lot of fun if that's what you're looking for. I have run headfirst into running for players who are kind of playing in that style, mm-hmm. and like they'll do things like they'll try and describe every single thing they're doing mm-hmm. in a room as I'm trying to get them to move on because there's nothing left in the room for them to explore. And they'll also do the thing where they don't want to tell me what their goal is, what they're trying to achieve, because they're worried that if they tell me what they're trying to achieve, I'm going to squash it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm a cream puff GM. Yeah. I'm fine. You know, tell me what you're trying to do and I'll help you get there.
I am trying to establish facts that you agreed are facts. And then when you realize what those facts actually mean, I'm going to say, you can't take it back now. No, yeah, I've definitely run into that too. And, you know, I am not saying either that the older type of D&D is bad compared to modern D&D. What I'm saying is it was a little bit different genre. It was, if we save the world, it's because we kind of tripped over this thing that we have to deal with. And the only way we're going to be able to take our treasure back home is if we deal with this thing right now, versus we are all motivated to save the world. It is a different paradigm, you know, in a lot of cases. The other thing that I was going to point out, we've got a lot of mileage off this first question, but the other thing I did want to point out is the system mastery piece is one side of things. Being familiar with the words is with the rules is one side of things. But you also mentioned, and I'm glad you did bring this up, is understanding tropes is another thing, because there are people that if they understand the genre that you're running and they understand the tropes that you're using, even if they don't understand the rules, as soon as they get a general idea of how the rules work, they are understanding what their character should be doing and what they should be helping other players doing and what they should be looking out for. And that is another vector of skill.
The first time I ran for my nieces, they were playing three characters. They entered a cave, and in front of them were three passageways. And their first response was like, let's each take a passageway and see where it goes. And I couldn't do that to them. I had to be like, hey, guys, Lorelai's character only has one hit point right now. You might not want to split up like that. And they're like, oh, yeah, you're right. And that's all just a matter of understanding the tropes a little bit.
Yeah. And again, too, I know we already hit this, but you don't have to be super skilled to play D&D. Nobody should expect somebody to have a certain level of skill, because it's not a game about winning, but there are things that you will be much more comfortable with when you have a better understanding of certain things in the game.
Right.
And sometimes when you have a really good understanding of the game and the tropes, you know exactly what the GM is doing with the story, and you know the exact mechanics to counter the foes that you're fighting, and then the DM has a 4-hour session that's over in 45 minutes. I kind of wanted to throw this in here too. When was the first time you really realized that other people have different tactical assumptions that didn't line up with how you played the game?
When the GM wouldn't let my rogue get an opportunity to backstab a character. I'm still angry about this one. I think I've talked about this one before, where I get a little mad at GMs who refuse. They want to play theater of the mind. They refuse to use tactical maps.
Mm-hmm.
But then they don't allow your character to get narrative positioning to use their special abilities.
Yeah.
And when this happened, I was like, oh, okay, he's not going to let me he's not going to let me do something cool so I can do this cool thing that my character is designed to do. So, okay, let's just, we don't play D&D with this GM anymore.
Yeah, Theater of Mind is great, but if somebody has different assumptions about when you can get somewhere, that is not great. And if you hit a certain type of GM, which you shouldn't be this type of GM, but certain GMs, when they think someone has the system mastery and they're worried about it, will look for opportunities to tell someone they can't do the thing their character should be able to do. And that is not a good way to deal with these things that we are talking about right now. I think my first shocked moment of realizing other people expected different things out of the game was very first convention I ever went to. Played a bard, and this was one of those, like you've talked about before, one of these tournament things that I don't think people are as used to now in conventions, where it was like, this is a three-part adventure, but everybody has to vote to see who's going to be who's going to be going on to the next part of the adventure. And it's not going to be, everybody that played in the first section. So I'm playing a bard in that first section. I have never played with people other than my friends from high school before. I've never gone to a convention before. Something clicked and I played the hell out of this bard. I loved it. I was hamming it up. I was getting other people to role play that were kind of being reserved. I was so happy and it was such a rush. And I get to the second round of this game and I tried to make sure that I still had the bard because you weren't necessarily going to get the same pre-generated character either. And there was a fight and the GM literally told me, well, you just wasted your attack. And I said, why? Because you didn't tell me that you moved into the room first. And he was very procedural like that. If you did not say that you did a thing and he thought it was a thing that you needed to explain in detail, then it wasn't just that you had to re-explain what you were doing or that you had a different option. It was you have wasted your time because you stood 15 feet away and were swinging your sword because somehow you thought you were close enough from 15 feet away to hit this thing.
I ran into that once. It wasn't D&D. It was Shadowrun, but same thing. Tournament, had a great time the first round. And this wasn't the, people chose who got to go through. It was basically like you played round one with one GM, played round two with another GM, and then all the GMs got together and decided which group did the best.
Mm.
We got to round two, got a new GM, and he TPK'd us in under 45 minutes. And we were like, what? And he's like, well, one, you didn't say you did this. You didn't say you did this. You didn't say this. I'm like, what are you talking about? That's one of my gamer war stories that I will rant about until the sun dies in the sky, because I was so mad. I sat there for an extra hour afterwards writing this long note about how awful that GM was and how angry I was at wasting my Saturday evening at Gen Con for that.
I wrote a similar letter about the GM in that one, and I was told that my GM for the first session usually ran Vampire, and I should probably look into playing that type of game.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Let's explore what it's like to run for new players. What has that experience been like for you?
Like I said, we've talked about this a little bit before. New players generally need a little more hand-holding because they're not sure what they're getting into. When new players are at the table, a lot of times you will have to kind of draw out of them what their character is doing. And it may seem like they're not as engaged as you think they are, because a lot is happening in their head. And I have found almost 9 times out of 10 when I am running for new players and I have a player who doesn't seem like they're very engaged, when the game is all said and done and I ask them if they had fun, they're like, oh yeah, that was fantastic. When do we do it again? Because like I said, there's a lot of heavy lifting happening in their head as they're taking it all in. And a lot of it is the tropes and the story and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so don't expect your novice players to be fully invested in role-playing and engaging with the game and being proactive and all this. They need few more breadcrumbs laid out for them to get into what's happening in the game.
I also think that, I mean, when you get feedback from someone that is really enjoying the game and they are brand new to it, though, I think that is extremely invigorating as a DM. Even if it's someone like that, that doesn't volunteer, but then eventually says, oh, no, that's one of the greatest things I've ever done. Even though it's like completely deadpan and they didn't say anything during the session, that just triggers something for a GM that somebody brand new is really loving this thing that you have loved for so long the same way that you do. Now, when I have run for people, I used to run for Adventurers League at the game store. I think this has changed a lot, but at the very beginning of 5e, there were a lot of people coming into Adventurers League that had never played D&D before. They had listened to Critical Role, and they found out that D&D existed, and then they found out that you could go play Adventurers League at the game store, and they were brand new people to the game. That was really neat, and this is a whole other discussion, but I do think that's something that Wizards and Adventurers League has kind of lost in the 10 years since the original rules came out. But what I would see there that would sometimes be a thing that you would need to address is I would have players that hadn't played for like 20 years, but had played an older edition. Then I would have somebody that maybe played once or twice, and then three other people that had never played before. Sometimes you do like any table. Sometimes you have that person that is a little bit too dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they are dominant about being wrong. So one of the things that you really need to do when you have a mixed table like that and you have newer players is to make sure you are listening to the voices of the new players. Don't let them get drowned out. Politely tell that person that is dominating things, I will get back to you, but I need to know what you want to do. And sometimes you even need to run it the same way you would run a combat, where it's like, you tell me a thing that you're doing, you tell me a thing you're doing, and you just, you don't have to roll for initiative, but just going like clockwise around the table to make sure that you have specifically asked everyone and not just relied on somebody being the loudest voice at the table.
Yeah, sometimes if you have a mixed table, it can be a godsend to have an experienced player there that knows, like, understands that they're dealing with new players, and they work to draw those players into the game and make it a little easier for you as a GM. They help them with the mechanics and stuff like that. But then you can also have the dominant player who doesn't understand those nuances and is just like barreling ahead and telling other people how to play their character and just stop.
And sometimes we have to revisit our assumptions, too, because what I ran into a few times in that, there would be people that would be like, we recovered this thing. I want to use this to craft this item. And I'm thinking, oh, this is Adventurers League. You can't do this, all this. They literally just wanted to be able to say, I made my own bow out of the wood of this thing that we broke down in order to get to this last villain. And, you know, I'm immediately rushing ahead to say, oh, they're probably going to want like a +2 bow out of this. And they're going to, you know, it's like, no, they just want to be able to say, hey, can I write down on my character sheet that I made my own bow out of this thing because we're proud that we accomplished this? And then I'm like, yes, you can totally do that. That is great.
I do think another thing to keep in mind when you're running for novice players is you may need to help them a little bit more with some of the things their character can do. And I'm not saying you need to understand every nuance on the character sheet in front of a new player, but if you are running at a low level, you'll understand different things, like things a rogue should keep in mind to make sure they get their sneak attack damage. One of the things I dealt with running for my niece and her friends was she was playing a druid and she kept trying to hit things with her cudgel, and I'm like, you want to cast Shillelagh first, but I just want to bonk it on the head. And I'm like, yes, but Shillelagh is your bonk spell, but I don't want to cast a spell. No, you cast Shillelagh on the club to make the club magic and hit harder. Oh, okay. I swear to God, I could not get the bard to use bardic inspiration until the very last time we played. And it wasn't like I was trying to force them to do anything. It was just kind of a, hey, just a reminder, don't forget you have that ability. Don't forget you have this cool thing you can do. some of them leaned into it and some of them were like, I don't want to waste it.
Well, and the funny thing, you know, thinking about that too, is even when somebody is used to how things are supposed to work, not everybody is always running on all their cylinders all the time. Because let me tell you, as somebody that has played the game for 40 years, I still play a ranger once in a while and forget to cast Hunter's Mark before I shoot something.
Oh, yeah, I should have cast that before I fired the bow. Okay.
Well, it's on them now. One of the other things I was going to say that happens a lot is you will have players get very enthusiastic and they will want to do, like, in combat, I have these 10 things that I would like to do now that it is my turn. And you do have to curb that a little bit to, you know, make sure it's okay. You can do this thing, but that's probably all you're going to be able to do. But that'll set you up to do this next thing next time. And, you know, sometimes it is a matter of just getting people used to it. It is still a game, even though we're telling a story. Another thing that I think is important is if you are going to want people to be more engaged with the rules, it is not a bad thing to let them skirt over some rules once in a while. But sometimes it's okay to also tell them that they're skirting over some rules. Like, you can tell them, normally you couldn't do that, but we're going to not worry about that for now because, you know, we're in the middle of this thing and it's going to work perfectly well if we do this. But then later on, they're not blindsided when you say, no, you actually can't do that normally.
I think it's very important when you're running for new players, specifically new players, novice players in general too, but new players, you need to walk that fine line between showing them how the game system works, but also letting them do cool stuff. Because there are so many players out there who will tell you the first time they played was awful and they never played again for 10 years until somebody they were close to had them play again. And it's that, I don't want to say bad GM, but it was a bad game and they didn't have fun because they weren't allowed to do anything cool and they didn't understand what was happening and they just kind of felt steamrolled or neglected or forgotten, or why am I here? I can't do anything cool. You know, so you really have to walk that fine line between letting them learn what the rules are and how the way the game system works and giving them a fun time.
So when is it that you can kind of tell that somebody is transitioning from being that new person that doesn't quite get all the tropes, or that person that has no idea that they're actually using rules and they're just hoping they're doing it right and showing their character sheet to somebody else, to actually starting to feel like they get it, that you can take those training wheels off?
Generally, I think it's when they start utilizing stuff on their character sheet that you usually had to guide them into doing before. You know, it's understanding when is a good time to cast Fireball, understanding when is a good time to cast Spectral Guardians, you know, knowing that position you need to get into to get your sneak attack damage. It's like usually it's when they start learning the rules of their character, I think.
I think that is true. The way I was thinking of it is there is a point at which somebody quits coming to you and saying, I want to do X, how would I do that? And instead comes to you and say, look at this, I made a character that can do X now. You know, it's that idea that now they are actually saying, well, I would like to be able to fireball people, but I would also like not to fireball my party. How can I do that? Oh, I'll be an evoker. You know, I'll sculpt spell here. And that's, you know, that's when you do start realizing that they are looking at the rules outside of the game. They are looking things up between turns. You know, that's that thing that starts to click with them a little bit more.
Yeah.
So what do veterans do at the table? Because this is, you would think from how we were talking about this, that it's like, oh, great to have veterans. Not as great to have newbies. That is not true. There veterans, is something good about both of them, and veterans can be tricky.
Veterans will take your encounter, pick it up, shake it out, wring it out, and toss it in the trash. Mm-hmm. And you won't know what happened to you because they just took the encounter you expected to last a solid hour, hour and a half. Finished it in 15 minutes and are asking you what's next.
Mm-hmm.
I exaggerate a little, but only a little. Only a little. I think we talked in one of our early episodes about how to craft encounters for our players. And in that episode, we talked about, you know, CR and like how you have to adjust for new players who don't understand how their characters work, and for veteran players who understand how their characters work and how they work together as a group. I almost always put together deadly encounters for my group because I know they're just gonna, they're gonna figure it out. They're gonna steamroll it. They know the tropes, and it's not even a metagaming level of, oh, it's a troll, use fire. You know, it's just a very quickly figuring out, okay, that creature seems to be, you know, that creature seems very agile. We shouldn't hit it with spells that use a dex saving throw. Hit it with something that has an int saving throw. You know, mm-hmm. It's like understanding those levels of minutiae, and also the getting yourself into position to let the rogue get into position to get sneak attack, not dropping a fireball on top of your fighter's head. Actually, drop a fireball on the fighter's head and then drop a synaptic static on the fighter. That made me mad.
I think the other thing is, too, veteran players should be making us do some of the things that we say we want to do anyway. And what I mean by that is, I don't know how many times, and I have said this myself, but that I've heard other people say, don't make your fights just about beating up the monsters that you put in front of people. Put other objectives in there, put other things they need to accomplish in addition to the fight. Now, that's not true of every single fight. If you're running into a bunch of guards, that's fine. You don't need to have a secondary objective. But especially when you're getting to like that climactic fight, you should probably have something more going on than just the person standing there trying to wallop on them and them walloping you back. Because that's when somebody that has very sound tactics and that understands the tropes and maybe the rules, maybe just the concept of how these fights go, they're going to tear apart that one person that you put in there, no matter how powerful they are, because they're going to understand that they can outmaneuver them. They can make things hard for them. So you need to have that multiple vector for people.
Yeah, when you run for veteran players who are very good at tactical play, you need to play the adversaries as smart.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm running for novice players, my monsters aren't necessarily going to be as smart as they should be, because I know that if I play the adversaries optimally against a bunch of newbies, I might steamroll them. I might TPK that group. And I don't want to do that to a bunch of new players, because that kills enthusiasm. My veteran players that have been doing this for years and work really well together, they're going to be fine if I have the monsters, you know, tactically, you know, moving around and targeting the same character. Right there, that's one of the things that you'll see, that graduation from season to veteran, is they'll know, have everyone focus on the same character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll run for a bunch of novice players and they're each going to pair off against a monster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's going to make the fight go a lot longer. By the time they're seasoned, they start understanding, oh, let's take out this character. That one's the biggest danger. Veteran players get this, and you'll have the, you know, a lot of MMO language. You know, you'll have the, you know, the person who's playing control and management of the battlefield, while the damage dealers, the DPS, are in there dealing with, you know, whittling down things and taking them out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, video games are a very big influence on modern gaming, and I think seasoned veteran players understand that, okay, there's reasons you do certain of these things. And it's not necessarily to turn our tabletop games into video games, because there's so much more nuance we can get into on a tabletop game. But those video game skills and references and understanding do seep in to our tabletop games.
Something that I've thought of, because we have both talked about this before, you know, about being more heart, you know, being less heartless DMs than other DMs that we know, and both of us are like this. And the thing is, with people that are very tactically oriented and very competent with the rules, sometimes it feels like you're not as good with tactics when you're playing with those characters or with those players. But sometimes it's just the fact that you have to get over being a nice GM. And I don't mean, like rocks falls, everybody dies. What I mean though, is like, I will usually have a monster that has three attacks. If there's three PCs, I'll have it hit all three PCs. I won't have it focus on one PC until it drops them. In a more tactical group, if there is one person that is more of a threat, that monster's three attacks are all going to go after that person that's more of a threat.
Yeah.
If I am running something like ghouls and somebody is at zero hit points and making death saves, I am going to have the ghouls stop and make an attack on them while they are down and give them an extra death save, because the ghoul is going to take a bite out of them. And I wouldn't necessarily do that if somebody was less tactically sound. And it feels mean, but what it really is the cleric that is also doing all sorts of tactical things now has to break off from what they are doing and save that person. And it's probably not even that difficult for them to do it, but it is making them have to deal with a different thing other than just whatever they were planning on doing otherwise.
Yeah. As I call myself, I'm a cream puff GM. It feels bad sometimes doing that to people, but if your players are extremely experienced and extremely good with the rules, this is the exciting stuff for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't want to do it in a way that's going to like beat them down and, you know, make them frustrated playing the game. You never want to be the adversarial GM, but you want to give your players challenges that they can overcome and succeed against. And sometimes that means putting them in that really tight spot.
You know what the meanest thing I ever learned how to do in third edition when things were very tactical and it was difficult to deal with somebody that had like a 30 armor class and even dragons couldn't hit them? Dragons could grapple them perfectly well, and dragons can fly. Falling damage is a thing that armor does not help against.
Let's see how you do with terminal velocity, bub.
Dragon picks them up and says, hey, I learned this from eagles that used to hunt things with shells. Oh, goodness. So as a side thing here, because this comes up a lot in discussions about tactics and rules mastery and optimization, does tactical play automatically take away from role playing?
I don't think so. I mean, it can. It can. If that is all the GM is focused on, if that is all the players are focused on, yes, it can take away from having those opportunities to role play. But I don't think it inherently means you have to forego either of them.
Yeah.
My Saturday groups, they're tactical players. They really love getting into the nitty gritty of a fight and dealing with it. But they also love those moments where they get to role play, where I get to throw story stuff at them and they get to have those story beats and those emotional moments or those exciting, fun, goofy moments where they're in town or dealing with something or just having a conversation with a random treant out in the woods. It doesn't have to take away from role playing. And you can even, as a GM, still pull the role playing into that encounter. Have your adversaries saying things, doing things, like encouraging the other players to do the same in the fight. Talk about how something is relevant to a character's past, their current present, or something that character is interested in, or, you know, something that's going on, or like, oh, hey, your best friend over there, they're in trouble. You know, what are you doing about this? You can play up the story in a tactical fight just as well as you can without having it be a tactical fight.
And you don't necessarily want to do this every single time, especially when somebody has like three attacks around. But once in a while, ask somebody what something they just did looked like so that you bring that story back into it and you kind of move it a half step away from just math.
Yeah. It's like I said earlier when I was talking about the Cygnus de Gure game, I love getting to play Selena being a badass. It's like, yeah, he casts reverse gravity again. Okay. She jumps into it, does the athletics check, does a superhero landing on a ceiling, and then starts fighting things. It's like, it's so much fun to describe that type of thing. And it's all tactically taking advantage of the situation and the fight.
Yeah, and, you know, this is, it reminded me of something fairly early in 5th edition when I was still looking at the monk and going, oh, wait, I can actually do cool stuff, as opposed to 3rd edition monks. I'm sorry, as a cheap shot, but it's true. Anyway, no, we were playing Prince of the Apocalypse, and we were in way over our heads in an encounter. My Goliath monk grabbed the halfling in the party and the gnome in the party and said, I am going to go here if you guys can last one more round delaying them. And I literally ran up to the wall, and because this was a Goliath and a monk, I did Step of the Wind and jumped over the keep wall with both of them. And it was awesome, and it was something that was mechanical because I needed to know how far I could jump and how far I could move. But also, that was totally a story moment there, too.
Yeah.
Now that we've talked about people that are newer to the game and newer to rules and the genre, and people that are very genre savvy and very tactical minded and really understand the rules, what range here is the most challenging to run for?
Most challenging? I mean, it goes back and forth. I find running for new players to be exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to find that balance of not putting a whole lot of effort into setting up the session, having enough that I can give the player something fun, but not putting so much in there that, like, I have to prep differently. Mm-hmm. If I'm prepping for my season Saturday veterans season, I keep saying season veterans, running for my veterans on Saturday versus running for the novice teens I was playing for, I couldn't put nearly as much effort into the prep because it would have been kind of wasted. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean, mm-hmm, it wouldn't have been relevant to them. That wasn't what they were enjoying while playing. They were much more focused on, let's have a couple of fun fights and maybe quip funny stuff at each other.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it is very challenging to prep for running for the veteran players because it takes a lot of effort to make sure I'm giving them a challenging encounter that's fun and enjoyable for them. And I have to make sure I have all my ducks in a row so I can kind of guess what questions they're going to ask, because they're also going to dive straight into that story and they're going to think of things that I didn't think about. And, you know, so I have to prep a lot more for the veteran players, and I also need to be prepared for them to shortcut my encounters in ways that I don't expect.
First off, I think a lot of this comes down to what we kind of talked about at the beginning, which is there are two different vectors, at least, when you talk about people's level of engagement. There is that understanding the concept of the story, and then there is the understanding how the game works as a game. Like you said, there are times when I can get very worn out running for newer players, but if it's somebody that is very invested in the tropes and they're big fantasy fans and they are engaging with the story on that level and they understand how characters should act in this situation, that is much less difficult for me to deal with. In fact, it kind of feeds energy back to me than somebody that, as an example, somebody that maybe likes playing Magic the Gathering, so they want to try out D&D. And they are very much looking at this from a mechanical standpoint, but they're new. Mm-hmm. So they're like, wait, I don't know which attack I want to use. And they'll get really bogged down in the minutia, and you'll kind of have to stop because they want to know the rules now. You know, that kind of thing does kind of wear on me a little bit more than if somebody is just very enthusiastic, but knows exactly what, you know, a paladin is supposed to be doing, even if they don't understand how a smite works.
Yeah, I think it basically comes down to the two spectrums. There are different hardships as a GM, and there's different rewards you get from it.
Mm-hmm.
Having a new player tell you that was so much fun and they can't wait to do it again, is that makes all of the effort and exhaustion totally worth it. At the same time, like, I get spoons. I get a lot of joy, mm-hmm, from running for my Saturday groups when they really get into the story and the encounters are good and they're having a good time. You know, like, I like that. I can do all day.
The other thing is, you know, we talked about the very tactically minded veteran players. I can get very worn out when they want every fight to be a tactical challenge.
Yeah.
When they are bringing their A game to the four goblins that wandered onto their camp while they're taking a short rest, that can be very tiring, because then it's like every time we roll initiative, I need to be thinking about every possible thing that's going on. And I don't necessarily, I'm trying to think of what's next in the story progression, not just when we're rolling initiative next.
Right.
But just like, you know, when we were talking about everything not being about the mechanics, even when people understand the mechanics, I have had players that are very, very mechanically focused, very good at tactics, but they only really want to pull off that cool thing maybe once a story arc. And they don't want to run roughshod over those goblins or even like a few ogres that they run into. They want to run roughshod over, you know, the demon lord that they know is at the end of this adventure.
For me, if the players are leaning into the story, that's what really is what I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still playing D&D. I still want to punch evil in the face and be a big damn hero. But the story bits I really get excited about.
Definitely. And, you know, honestly, part of it is just finding mechanics that you like yourself so you don't get burned out when you're dealing a lot with those mechanics.
Right.
And that's not necessarily the game's fault. That is an alignment between how the game does things and how your brain works. What's some advice you would share for people trying to match the games to their players that they have at the table? And I think this could be really interesting because I've had newbies and very tactically sound and in the middle all at the same table before.
I think it is very important for you as a GM to start to understand what your comfort level is. What are you looking to get out of running games? You know, where is your enjoyment in running games? And once you start to figure that out, you can have a better handle on how to prep for the players and their various skill levels at your table. Generally speaking, I don't like mixing novice and veteran players because, you know, the novice players can get overwhelmed, the veteran players can start getting bored, but putting some seasoned players with the novice players or putting seasoned players with the veteran players, that can all be fine. That can help. That can help things along in a lot of different ways. As a GM, understand what it is you enjoy and learn how to set your own boundaries about what you're willing to run for the group.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things I was going to say for people that are less tactically minded, and this is something that I have an example of just from that Ravenloft game, don't be afraid to give them something that might be overpowered for another party so that when they get into trouble, they can pull the trigger on it. Like, you know, giving them a few extra healing potions or giving them, you know, that necklace of fireballs, which can be dangerous if they don't watch their area of effect. But still, you know, giving them that, you know, that extra, you know, necklace of fireballs to throw at something that's really bad, even lower level than you would normally for other players, that can make up for a lot. And they still feel like they are doing something. They're still engaging with the rules. They're just not worrying as much about tactics because now it's, hey, I have this really cool thing and I should probably spend it now. And that can be more substantive for them at times.
I think it's also important to be clear about your expectations for the players. I have played with people in the past who should not be novice players. They mm-hmm. have been playing long enough that they should be able to play the character on their sheet, but they don't put the effort into learning the rules of how their character works. And therefore, every single time they're like, how do I do this again? And I want to be there for new players. I don't want to be there for the player who's been playing for 5 or 6 years and still hasn't learned how to do their character. Learn how to play your character. It is okay to tell your players, I expect you to understand how the mechanics of your character works, especially if you've moved beyond the players are brand new. You know, you've mm-hmm. played through a few levels. They've got some experience. It's also on the other side of the spectrum. It's okay to tell your veteran players, hey guys, I'm not up for getting into the nitty gritty of this tonight. This is supposed to be just a fun combat. Let's let's not get too deep into the weeds on stuff.
The other thing I was going to say when you're talking about that is we have spent a lot of this discussion on extremes, but I honestly believe there are a lot of players that reach a medium level of, you know, of rules engagement and a comfortable level of, I will play my character, I will have fun, but I'm not going to super deeply engage with things. And I think I've had more of those than I have the tactically minded veterans or the people that aren't picking up on things. And that's kind of the sweet spot in a lot of ways. Like, sometimes you may want them to be a little bit more engaged, but as you were saying, like, knowing how to run your character, that's not even a system mastery thing. It doesn't matter how you built the character, but know where Fireball is in the book so you can look it up so you're ready to do it on your turn instead of saying, oh, everybody, I forgot. I got this really neat spell. What section of the book is it in? And they've been playing for 5 years.
Yeah, it's okay that happens once in a while. It's just you will start to notice the repeat offenders who don't bother learning the way their character works. And that's just frustrating.
It wasn't D&D, but the worst example of that I can remember is when I was running Mutants and Masterminds, and I had somebody, every time I gave them points to spend, he would be like, I want to be able to do this, build it for me. And it's like, no, I'm building the villains. You should learn how to do this.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay to ask for help. You know, it's okay ask for guidance.
Yeah,
if the GM has access to, like, Hero Labs or something like that, they can click a couple of buttons and give you the thing, but at the same time, learn how your character works.
Yeah, and honestly, you know, this is, again, the secret to almost every single discussion in RPGs is you should be able to communicate with people and have meaningful communication, actively listen to one another, and take advantage of the things that you are gathering from that information. And I know sometimes that is a very simple thing, but that's what a lot of things boil down to when it comes to advice on things.
Yep. I think we've kind of covered this topic, so let's...
Yeah, I think so.
Let's start getting out of here.
We're veterans of this topic.
I mean, we've been doing this show for 2 years. We probably better be veterans at it at this point.
Now let's join Edge and Jared for some downtime research, where they do the work so we don't have to.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related in D&D that we want to pass along to the listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, or podcasts, but it will always be something that we think will enhance your D&D experience. First up, though, our Eldritch Invocation. We have a Patreon now, so if you'd like to help us do this show and provide some additional content for you, we would love it if you decide to join. We've got our own Discord, and we'll be releasing additional supplementary material like the map Chris made for the campaign setting we're currently playing in. And it's basically patreon.com/thac0wa. And there'll be links in the show notes and stuff. So my little thing I wanted to bring up is if you're up for some tugs on your heartstrings, there's a great article on NPR celebrating 50 years of Dungeons & Dragons. They reached out to their readers and collected 5 short stories about how D&D has impacted people's lives. Each one is a glimpse into how this hobby of ours can impact us in unexpected ways. The title is Dungeons & Dragons Turns 50 This Year, Here's What the Game Has Meant to You. And all of them made me go, oh, you know, like all of them were like really maybe bittersweet stories sometimes, but they were all very good. And we'll have a link in the show notes.
I mean, I know as an adult, there was a time period when I tried not to game because I was too grown up for it. And it didn't take me long to realize, no, this is part of me and I need to game. This is not a thing that I need to set aside.
Yep.
So the thing I wanted to bring up is, first off, I love RPG magazines. I know that the era of magazines has long faded, but there's nothing that hits me quite the same as having a D&D magazine with 3 or 4 really neat articles that have these ideas that I can read over lunch and then just think about the whole afternoon how I would use something or how I would do differently. I love that. I've loved that ever since I got my first Dragon magazine back when I was in junior high. MCDM's Arcadia was scratching that itch for a while, but MCDM moved on from doing 5e content, and they aren't necessarily doing a magazine, at least at the moment, for their new RPG while they're developing it. So, what's nice is there is a new magazine coming out, and it is being produced by the editor-in-chief for Arcadia for most of the lifespan of it that took over after James Introcaso was editor-in-chief, and that is Hannah Rose. She has founded a company called Wild Mage Press with Clara Daly, and they are putting out a new RPG magazine called Horizons. The first issue should be hitting about October 9th, and you can subscribe on their website or on their Patreon. Their current plans are to do 3 5e SRD D&D type articles and then have a fourth article that is from a different RPG, which is really scratching that old Dragon magazine feel, because I remember, you know, getting that weird oddball RPG that I'd never even looked at before in there after reading all my D&D articles. Their example that they mentioned is they have like a Pathfinder 2e article lined up, and they have something for Candela Obscura coming up as well. So we will have a link to their website in the notes. I am looking forward to this, and I just wanted to make sure all of you had a chance to look at it too. We are happily part of the Polygamerus Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamerus podcast, like...
The Heroes of Hovel's Way. The Heroes of Hovel's Way is an epic fantasy story about two young heroes, Odie and Aramon. These heroes have the potential to deal with a dire threat from an ancient time that is poised to return to the world. A titan destroyer, Valhalmoris, the Mountain Strangler, stirs. The fate of the Barony of Castakin may be in their hands. We play the game to find out. We invite you to join us on the journey.
That sounds like a really neat show. We should listen to that.
Sounds like a fun game. I wish I was playing.
Yeah. We used up all of our resources, so I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll go exploring with us when we start our next adventure.